Welcome to the Asia Chessboard, the podcast that examines geopolitical dynamics in Asia and takes an inside look at the making of grand strategy. I'm Andrew Schwartz at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
This week, Mike discusses the nuclear pieces on the Asia chessboard with Caitlin Talmadge, professor at Georgetown University, as they explore the multipolar nuclear deterrence environment in the Indo-Pacific region. Mike and Caitlin analyze U.S. and Chinese nuclear capabilities, the potential for nuclear arms races in the region, and the relationship between nuclear and conventional forces.
Welcome back to the Asia Chessboard. We're going to talk today about nuclear strategy, nuclear deterrence, extended deterrence, proliferation, one of the most important parts of the chessboard, and one we haven't really addressed in detail yet on this podcast, but we have picked the perfect person to help us navigate those issues. Professor Caitlin Talmadge, a colleague at Georgetown and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of some prize-winning books on how dictators fight wars, on the origins of defense policy, but particularly focused on theory and practice of extended deterrence and nuclear deterrence. And right now in the Indo-Pacific, that is becoming the hot topic with the nuclear posture review and all sorts of other developments brewing in the region. Caitlin, welcome.
Hi, great to be here.
So we always begin with you. And although we're colleagues at Georgetown, I don't know the answer to this either. How did Caitlin Talmadge get into nuclear weapons? I bet your parents are asking that too. I know you were at CSIS, like all great strategists at one point, but how did this journey bring you to your expertise today?
Sure thing. Yeah, well, it's great. It's great to be here. Thank you so much for the opportunity to chat with you. Big fan of you and your work and the podcast. So, I mean, I think the simple answer to how I got into all this was I've kind of always had the bug, the security studies bug. I remember being a nine-year-old kid when Iraq invaded Kuwait and being really, really interested in that and like writing a fourth grade short story about that, which was kind of weird at the time. Just always wondering like, why did that happen? Why did the US respond? Why did other countries join in? And that kind of got me into reading the newspaper and just paying attention to issues surrounding the use of force and the politics surrounding the use of force. And eventually in college, I got really into issues surrounding arms control, nuclear weapons, wrote my senior thesis on that, came to work at CSIS, as you mentioned, and had some really outstanding mentors there working on nuclear issues. And, did a bunch of work in graduate school looking at conventional defense issues, but have come back to nuclear studies because as I'm confident we're going to talk about today, the nuclear and the conventional are very intertwined. And you really, I think in today's landscape, have to understand both in order to say anything about military operations or defense issues or U.S. foreign policy. And certainly that's true in the Asia context that we'll be talking about today.
A lot of people who start on the journey you just described, you know, they quickly get lumped into being either arms controllers or they are, you know, deterrence experts. And you've managed to, I don't know, defy that kind of pigeonholing or maybe bridge the different schools? How would you describe yourself in the larger debate about nuclear weapons?
I think I am very much in the middle. I think sometimes that's a problem that we have in the very accurately characterized nuclear landscape that you just mentioned, where we sort of have ideological camps almost, where you're either an arms controller and you're part of that club or you're part of the deterrence club and, you know, never the twain shall meet. I actually think there's incredibly smart people on both sides of that debate who are very dedicated to making the world safer, advancing U.S. interests, and people who are just really smart. I just learn a lot from listening to friends in both of those camps. And, you know, I think that the funny thing is often they're, you know, they kind of want the same things. And the question is, you know, how do you get there? And, you know, I think, for instance, that deterrence and arms control are kind of two sides of the same coin. Like you should be designing your arms control policies in ways that actually enhance deterrence. And there are ways that you can do that. And so it's a smaller group, I would say, that's kind of not clearly affiliated with either side. But we are out there. And, you know, I think honestly, a lot of policymakers actually are kind of in that group, kind of in the middle, although they're not often as vocal as you would hear kind of on Twitter and in the blogosphere and so forth.
Yeah, I imagine your time as an RA at CSIS grounded you a bit before your PhD in terms of what is, as a practical matter, achievable with policy. Did you work with Clark Murdoch?
So I was hired by Kirk Campbell. I had interned for the Washington Quarterly, worked for Alex Lennon when I was in college, and had the opportunity there to meet Michelle Flournoy and Kirk Campbell. And I can't remember the exact circumstances, but I made it back to CSIS for an interview with Kurt my senior year in college, and he hired me on the spot to work for Michelle. I can remember it very vividly in his office. And, you know, that was the days before people did so much over email and this and that. It was just kind of, you're hired, a handshake, show up after Labor Day. And I had the opportunity to learn from him and to learn from Michelle. And yes, of course, Clark was there. Kath Hicks was in the office next door. Austin Carson, who's now a professor at the University of Chicago, was in my windowless office with me. So it was a really great place to learn about all of these issues and, you know, have really smart thinkers, at the top of their intellectual game, but people also who understood the policy process and politics at the highest level. And it was definitely an amazing crucible in which to spend, you know, a brief but really important period between college and grad school.
And that was in the period when CSIS was in the old buildings. So you probably actually felt like you were in a nuclear bunker preparing to survive the eschaton, right?
Yeah. I was not in the Taj Mahal in which you currently reside. So yes, but I do have very fond feelings every time I walk by 18th and K because there are just so many great people there. And I'm so grateful for the experiences that I had.
So you worked for Kurt. I didn't realize that. So you've had an early interest in Asia. So let's turn to the region. I mean, how would you describe the role of nuclear weapons in strategic stability in Asia up to this point? And is it changing?
I think it's definitely changing. I think nuclear weapons are way more prominent and central to the politics of the region than they have been, even in the relatively recent past. I mean, I was thinking about just the change over my lifetime the other day. So my birthday's next week, I'm going to be 41. So I was born in 1980. And, you know, what was Asia like in 1980 on nuclear issues versus how is it today? Well, if you think back, you know, the Soviets were an Asian nuclear power and the Americans were an Asian nuclear power. But China at that time was barely an Asian nuclear power. I mean, they had a very small, very recessed, borderline unusable nuclear arsenal, maybe 150 warheads, which was about half the size of the British and the French arsenals at the time. So we're talking pretty small and also not very capable, not able to pose a really credible threat of hitting Moscow or Washington. You had the Pakistanis seeking nuclear weapons at that time. You had India having tested, but having a really small recessed arsenal at best. So really a region where you didn't have major indigenous nuclear powers. You kind of had the superpower nuclear shadow hanging over the region, but it really looks different from how it is today, because today the Soviet or now Russian nuclear arsenal hasn't really gone anywhere. I mean, it's smaller, but it's still capable. The Americans are more capable in many ways, even though the arsenal's smaller. But in terms of regional players, you have legitimate, real regional nuclear actors in Asia today that, you know, did not used to be there. China, in particular, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more today, has made some really significant strides in its nuclear arsenal since the 1980s, both quantitatively and qualitatively. You have the Pakistanis with a full-blown nuclear arsenal and a capability to engage in coercive nuclear escalation against India. You have India with a full-blown nuclear arsenal and growing counterforce capabilities, meaning nuclear capabilities that can take out other states' nuclear capabilities. Obviously, you know, the Pakistanis being the main concern for them, but China a concern for India as well. And then, of course, North Korea. You know, you have a country that has totally emerged as a nuclear power with intercontinental ballistic missiles that I think pose a credible, not a perfect threat, but, you know, how credible does the threat have to be, to paraphrase Bob Jervis, a credible threat to the American homeland. And then on top of all that, I see you, your eyes are maybe glazing over, but the list is so long, Mike. You know, you have these hedgers in the region, right? You've got South Korea getting ballistic missile submarines that are for conventional missiles, but boy, they could carry nuclear weapons maybe. And Japan investing in long range conventional for now strike capabilities. So the whole landscape looks different. And you've got not only, I think, more nuclear actors, which is a change, but I think you have more potential for arms races or crises that involve multiple players. So you're no longer just talking about nuclear dyads, but you're talking about triangles and maybe even more than one triangle that intersects with another one. So, you know, the US, North Korea, and China, and China, India, and Pakistan. And I have some forthcoming work on this, but you got all these nuclear complexities. It's against the backdrop of worsening political relationships and broader military competition in the conventional domain in many of these relationships as well. So it's just, it's really different, I think, from how it was, you know, two, three, four decades ago.
When I was in grad school, John Mearsheimer wrote that a multipolar proliferation future in Asia would be stable, right? You just extend mutually assured destruction from a two-player game to a three-player game to a five, six, seven, eight-player game. Same dynamics hold, he argued. You clearly don't think that's right.
Well, I would like to think it's right. I always want to believe the elegant things that John says, and sometimes I do. But I look at exactly this question in some forthcoming work. And I think the argument for why it would be more stable in a multipolar nuclear deterrent environment, I certainly get, because I think in a three or more player nuclear war, the way to be a winner is to actually sit out the war and let your two adversaries fight a nuclear war and be the residual nuclear power, which should really, really strongly caution any rational state against starting a nuclear crisis, because it's just much, much harder to come out ahead when you're dealing with these coalitional nuclear politics. So I think it's true that if every state is a totally rational actor, multiplayer nuclear deterrence should strengthen stability, which I think is the argument John was probably getting at, although I'll have to look up that piece because I'm not sure I've read that. But I would imagine that that's sort of the Waltzian kind of logic. I think the problem, though, is that sort of environment with multiple nuclear players could be a very tense peacetime environment. Like, it could really incentivize and supercharge the incentives for arms racing precisely because of those kind of coalitional nuclear politics, right? Like, you've got to, let's say you want a damage limitation capability. Well, now you need to have it against, you know, two potential adversaries, not one, right? It raises what the bar for survivability or, you know, even more ambitiously, damage limitation would be. And so you may have more competitive peacetime nuclear behavior, which increases the propensity for crises. And, you know, it also, I think when you have multiple players, just in general, you may have more likelihood of crises because there's more ambiguity, there's more opportunity for miscalculation and misperception. And then when you're in a crisis, I think signaling is also going to be really hard. You know, if you, and imagine if you had two separate crises involving two different dyads with some overlap occurring at the same time, right? So, like, you know, India and China at the same time that China and the US are in a crisis. So, you know, is China going to de-escalate in the crisis versus India if that makes them more vulnerable in the ongoing crisis versus the US? If the US alerts its forces to try to send a signal to China, does it inadvertently freak out the North Koreans? I mean, there's a rational story about why this all is very stabilizing, but of course, nuclear deterrence should already be pretty stabilizing. So I feel like the effects are kind of marginal, whereas the propensity to amp up peacetime nuclear competition, to have more crises and to have those crises be more escalatory, is something that I worry about. I don't sleep super soundly contemplating this future.
You have a cheery disposition given that. So what is the triangles? And you mentioned the US, India, China triangle, but of course that then has a collateral effect on Pakistan's calculations.
Yes.
And what you're describing when you have these expanding triangles is you're talking about states, because eventually you get to North Korea and you get to Pakistan. You're talking about states with less transparency, where we have less confidence in civilian control, where we have less confidence in proliferation control, outward and inward. We have less confidence in rational actor status.
Yes.
So you're describing a situation where we're not talking a sort of establishment Japan or South Korea. The more this dynamic unfolds, the more it starts to spill over to states that are less predictable, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And I would just note that I think even your standard rational actor type states, the US and the Soviet Union, had some scary episodes with this. I mean, I think neither side wanted crises in the Cold War, but they still stumbled into them sometimes. I mean, crises did still happen in part because even in that two-player situation, there were instances of ambiguity. If you think about how the Berlin crises started, if you think about the Cuban Missile Crisis and really look into the origins of those, and I'd be happy to go off on a long tangent about this if you want to. But, you know, I think both sides would say, well, I didn't really start this crisis, or I didn't go into this deliberately selecting into, in, to use political science language, a crisis with a nuclear armed opponent. I kind of stumbled into it. And then when it was on, it spiraled a bit until we were able to arrest the spiral. And so I would say, you know, even the history of the Cold War makes me not feel great about the assumption that rational states will not enter nuclear crises because of the fear of escalation. I hope that's true. But I think exactly as you said, as you have more and more states and also more and more states that may have even less restraint on, you know, military control over nuclear weapons, or more propensity for accidents or mistakes because of all kinds of organizational pathologies that you can imagine. I mean, just all of those sorts of concerns amplify, I think, as you look out across more and more players with more and more diverse politics. So yeah, I mean, that would be my answer to John, I think.
So the consequences of this increasing nuclear arsenal buildup on a multipolar basis, you described really well. Where do you think it comes from? And maybe focus in for a minute on China's, well, what appears to be very significant upgrading of its strategic nuclear forces. Why would China be incentivized to do that? What does it mean for the dynamic you're talking about? And what do you think is going on?
Sure. Well, I mean, I should start by saying, you know, I do think what's going on with China is very significant. I think we have to be careful not to overstate it and sort of not get ahead of the evidence, because, you know, the U.S. has been predicting that China's arsenal is going to double, you know, every year for the last 30 years, you know, that the estimates come out. But I will certainly say, I mean, it's very clear that they are increasing their arsenal. And I think the most recent estimate is they're on track to double it roughly within the next few years. So going from about 200 warheads to maybe 400, which of course would still only be about a third the size of the you know, deployed U.S. Strategic arsenal. So it's small, but not as small as it used to be. And, you know, as I mentioned a bit earlier, the changes are both qualitative and quantitative. And I think it's important to pay attention to those, because it gets to your question about what's really the motivation here. You know, the quantitative changes, as I mentioned, are significant, but not, you know, not enormous yet. I mean, they are significant though, but qualitatively they're doing a bunch of stuff too. So they're improving the mobility of their forces, which actually is not helped by these silo fields that they built, right? Silos are actually, you know, very vulnerable, but they're doing other stuff like, you know, pursuing, you know, air-launched nuclear weapons, investing in nuclear ballistic missile launching submarines. So diversifying the platforms that they can launch nuclear weapons from, improving the accuracy of you know, their missiles. And they've got some capabilities which to me look quite different from what they've developed in the past. So the silos, you know, China's always had silos. I mean, you know, land-based long-range nuclear weapons are kind of the bread and butter of the Chinese nuclear arsenal, and have been for, you know, years and years. But they've got new stuff, like they have this intermediate range missile, the DF-26, which has apparently a so-called hot swapping capability, where it can rapidly switch between nuclear conventional warheads, you know, ejected from the same launcher, and which also appear to be, you know, pretty long range, like they can reach Guam, and they're very precise. So it kind of looks like a theater nuclear warfighting capability, certainly much more than a counter city or, you know, counter value second strike capability, which doesn't really need to be very accurate. You know, you might need to be longer range to reach, you know, the US, but that sort of stuff, you know, against the backdrop of massive Chinese growth in conventional forces, Chinese regional activities that I think are increasingly concerning and threatening to China's neighbors. You know, it's the context for all of this that I think, that I think matters. And to get to your question, you know, so why are they doing this? What's going on? I mean, I don't think China is doing this because they intend to wake up someday and launch a bolt from the blue nuclear strike on Los Angeles, which is kind of the, you know, the headline scenario that you sometimes hear about. I think what they might like to do, though, is be able to launch a conventional coercion campaign against Taiwan and stalemate the U.S. ability to escalate to the nuclear level or make nuclear threats to get China to back down. They're basically trying to, in my view, entrench the United States in a deeper state of nuclear vulnerability, mutual nuclear vulnerability, which, of course, will then make the conventional balance of power a lot more dispositive in the outcome of a crisis. And of course, at the conventional level, that is not a good news story for the United States and its friends in the region, right? China's conventional military capabilities are increasing. And I think it doesn't want to get in a situation where it's using those capabilities and it gets checkmated by US nuclear weapons. And, you know, to be clear, and kind of going back to the point I began with, China's nuclear arsenal is still not that capable compared to the US arsenal. I mean, and it's not just, you know, comparing arsenal size, I think kind of misses some of the point, because it's not just like, oh, you know, China has this many nuclear weapons and America has this many. It's that the US also has an incredibly impressive suite of counterforce capabilities that can render a small Chinese nuclear arsenal very vulnerable. So the United States has the ability to engage in strikes against China's nuclear forces, but also to use electronic warfare, cyber capabilities, long-range conventional precision strike to really neuter China's nuclear arsenal. And so, you know, I think it's interesting that it's not clear China's actually moving away from its first use pledge, for instance. I think it still very much could. I mean, I think that's a separate conversation and we can talk about that. But even if all they wanted to do was have a secure second strike retaliatory capability, given the advances in U.S. nuclear capabilities and especially U.S. counterforce capabilities, they would probably have to have a more robust nuclear arsenal than they have now. And so I think, you know, that's some of what's going on. And, you know, they want to have that nuclear stalemate. I just want to be careful not to say that I think, oh, this is all defensively motivated, because I think the reason they care about that stuff right. is because they may be revisionist at the conventional level.
Well, it's about survivability of their deterrent, which is yep. understandable. But as you say, it matters because they want that deterrent to be effective in, as you say, checkmating the U.S. and our allies should they decide to use force, not just against Taiwan, Japan and the Senkakus, the South China Sea, Australia. Yes. And so, you know, this nuclear debate ties directly to the larger strategic goal, which I think China has, which is to peacefully, but through a combination of coercion and bribery, become the hegemonic power in Asia. And end 100 years of shame. So the no first use doctrine, China's had a no first use doctrine, won't be the first to use nuclear weapons. Beginning in the late 90s, in the years of churn and debate after the Taiwan Missile Crisis, Taiwan Straits Crisis, the open source literature in China started to tease out the warfighting utility of tactical nuclear weapons in Taiwan and East Asia scenarios. So that's over 20 years now that people in the PLA system writing about doctrine have talked about the utility of nuclear weapons in theater campaigns, not retaliation against U.S. nuclear weapons. So I personally have never believed that China really has an NFU, a no first use policy. I think it's rhetorical. And China's had rhetorical policies on human rights, too, and autonomy for Hong Kong and autonomy for Tibet and the long, long list I will spare you. So do you really believe we should be believing that China has an NFU? Is it worth trying to maintain that myth, or should we just not let it slow us down or deter us?
My take on this is actually very similar to yours. I mean, and I have a larger project that I'm doing right now with Vipin Narang and one of our superb master students here at Georgetown, Lisa Michelini, where we look at adversary perceptions of no first use pledges in all the cases where they've been made. And that includes China's. And, you know, I would say one of the takeaways from our paper is the best way to figure out if a country is going to use nuclear weapons first or not is to look at your political relationship with that country and look at that country's military capabilities. And the rhetoric, honestly, is just that. It's rhetoric. And it's used instrumentally for all kinds of other purposes. And I would say, you know, up to the early 2000s, yeah, I thought China's no first use pledge was pretty credible, not because they had made a pledge, because of all the things I just told you about how fragile and nascent their arsenal was. I mean, I just didn't see their forces postured to engage in nuclear first use either. You know, certainly not for purposes of counterforce. They had no ability to do a sort of big preemptive counterforce first strike like we worried about with the Soviets, but also not for asymmetric coercive purposes, like the type of nuclear use we worry about with North Korea or with Pakistan or with the Russians today. They were not postured for it. Their arsenal was really recessed, would have taken them a long time to, you know, gear up for a strike during which they would have been vulnerable. They didn't have, you know, precise regional, precise kind of theater nuclear warfighting capability, all the things we were just talking about. So my view of their, lack of likelihood of using nuclear weapons first had very little to do with their rhetoric and everything to do with their posture. And the fact that, you know, like a lot of people at that time, I looked at the US-China overall relationship and I said, this would be nuts. Why would either country even get into a conventional war? You know, they're so economically intertwined. There's so many powerful interests in favor of engagement and peace. They're separated by an ocean. I mean, we all know these arguments. And, you know, I do think that my view of this has changed somewhat as, you know, developments have progressed over the last 10 or 20 years. Again, not even just because of some of the rumblings that you mentioned, where you do hear certain Chinese elites unofficially off the record, because, you know, this still has never been changed officially in any way. I mean, the official posture is China does have a no first use pledge, and that has not loosened officially or publicly at all. But yes, there's lots of chatter that makes you think, gee, they might be reconsidering this. But it's when you actually just look at the political and the military factors that you start to have doubts, right? I mean, first of all, the overall relationship is a lot more competitive, and you can actually imagine scenarios where the two countries could get into a conflict. I mentioned Taiwan, you mentioned East China Sea, South China Sea. I mean, this is not as crazy as it once sounded. But secondly, there's the military dimension, which is to say that China definitely is trying to ensure that the US cannot coerce it with nuclear weapons, but it also has a growing capability to actually engage in limited nuclear first use, or at least it is clearly kind of moving in that direction. I'm going to be very interested to see this China military power report that the Pentagon has. We've all been waiting every day for the last several months for this report to come out, and I think there's going to, you know, probably be some words about this. I don't find their pledge super credible, but I also just don't find it super relevant to, you know, I look at other indicators and, you know, that our research shows that states pretty much always look at these other indicators in trying to figure out if these pledges are credible.
So the Nuclear Posture Review is going to have to deal with all this. When Brad Roberts led this review in the Obama administration, there were proposals within the administration from Congress among experts that, for example, the U.S. should have its own no first use policy, that the U.S. should basically codify mutually assured destruction, you know, euphemistically called strategic stability with China. You know who really hated that? Japan, especially. But many of our allies. And, you know, Brad prevailed and the allies were pretty contented with how that came out. What are you expecting this time? It's more complicated. Are there voices for that kind of arms control approach that are credible? Do they put out a case for arms control with China? Maybe in a post-INF world, the deployment of our own capabilities might push them there. What do you expect, and what would you recommend, I guess, for the NPR?
So I do not expect in the NPR a move toward adoption of no first use, although I think that there will be serious debate over this. It may be formulated as a sole purpose, which is, I think, an important distinction. A sole purpose declaration would say that something to the effect of the sole purpose of U.S. nuclear weapons is to deter nuclear attack and respond to nuclear attack. So, you know, we don't use nuclear weapons, in other words, against non-nuclear countries and to deter non-nuclear attacks. And we don't use them before the other side has used them. I think this will be debated because there very much is a push, I think, in the arms control community to consider these ideas. You've seen bills introduced in Congress by Elizabeth Warren, Adam Smith, others, you know, pushing for the U.S. to adopt not just sole purpose, but I mean, a very clear, unequivocal, categorical U.S. will not use nuclear weapons first stance. And I think that there are definitely some in the Biden administration who really believe that that's an important direction for U.S. declaratory policy to go, that it would be stabilizing, that it would help improve U.S. credibility on arms control measures, that it would help us in arms control with China. My concern about doing that, and also the reason that I think that they will probably not ultimately be successful, goes back to the allies point that you made in asking the question. I think it also relates to the findings from the paper that I mentioned, which is to say, no first use pledges tend to be believed by allies and not be believed by adversaries. And to me, that's kind of the worst of all worlds, where you've made this change to your declaratory policy that makes the allies under your nuclear umbrella freak out, right? It makes South Korea worry, we're going to get attacked by North Korea and we have to ride out an attack with nuclear weapons before the US is going to do something, or makes Taiwan worry, we're going to be attacked by China. And of course, Taiwan's not a treaty ally, but everyone knows that this question is still relevant there. You know, Japan worries about these same things. And, you know, they will, I think, if there is a no first use pledge, want to see major compensatory demonstrations of US resolve in order to feel secure and stay in those alliances. So is that, you know, greater forward deployed conventional forces on their soil? You know, what does that look like to reassure them? Because I think that they are going to worry that, yeah, no first use means no first use. I could even see it going as far as we have to get our own nuclear weapons, because given that, you know, the U.S. is weakening the nuclear umbrella, we, you know, at a time when the threats to us are increasing, we really have to go our own way. And although I think there's a lot of obstacles to that in Japan, like in South Korea, like 70%, I think in recent polls, you know, say, sure, yeah, like, yeah, sure, let's get our own nuclear weapons. So, you know, my question to those who advocate these changes in U.S. declaratory policy would be, you know, are you ready to do these other things that are, I think, the downstream consequences? And then on the flip side, as far as what the benefits are of no first use, as I said, I think the real conundrum is, like, the allies believe it, but I still don't think our adversaries, yeah, would be likely to take this credible absent radical changes in U.S. force posture. Because I think that they will look at our force posture and say, you are still postured with the total capability to engage in multiple types of nuclear first use. So why should we believe your rhetoric?
Right. So I like the way you put it, the worst of both worlds. I think you put a stake through the heart of that one pretty well. And I'm with you. Where are you on the conventional and nuclear missile deployments by the U.S. in Asia? This came up, you know, first in the context of North Korean proliferation, but increasingly with China. And you have quite prominent Koreans and Japanese saying U.S. should deploy, and Americans saying we should deploy tactical nuclear weapons. We pulled them all out in 1991, of course, after the Cold War, but saying we should reintroduce them. Some Japanese officials, former officials, have said maybe just change Japan's non-nuclear principles to allow transit. You know, after the withdrawal from the INF Treaty, you know, in theory, we have more options. The politics are complicated. Would deployment of tactical nuclear weapons or ballistic missiles, cruise missiles capable of, you know, dual use capable, change the equation in a positive way? Wouldn't make a difference? More dangerous than good?
So I have to confess that I think this is one of those issues where both the dangers and the benefits, I think, can be overstated. And a lot of the impact would depend on the specifics and the context. Let me back up one step before I elaborate on that and just say that my biggest question whenever I hear this issue raised is, so who specifically is going to host these things?
Right.
That's even true for conventional. You
and
know,
that doesn't mean which country, but which neighborhood in Japan wants these tactical.
Exactly.
Democracy is not an easy thing, right?
Exactly. And so, you know, I hear people paint the picture of deterrence and also ring the alarm bells. And I'm sort of always like, back up again and tell me who's gonna host these. You mentioned the transit point. And yeah, I mean, you hear people talking about, well, maybe it will be sort of like the TLAM ends, the you know, the nuclear tomahawks, where they come into port, but, you know, we look the other way and they, you know. So I always wonder about that when I hear this. And I have not heard a good answer to that question. But if we could put that aside, even so, I'm not convinced that they're strategically essential, but I'm also not convinced that they will ignite some regional arms race. You know, I think that The reason we might deploy forces like that is to try to strengthen the credibility of our extended deterrence, right? But there's other ways that we do that, right? We could do that with other types of conventional forces. You know, we've already done that in some ways with things like the Japanese and South Korean extended deterrence dialogues, where, you know, we didn't designate a certain class of nuclear weapons as, you know, these are your nuclear weapons. You know, we're going to put them on your territory so that you know that they belong to you and they will be used to defend you. But we just had more interchanges with them to try to, and even bringing them to the United States. I mean, showing them, you know, CONUS-based nuclear weapons and just saying, look, you know, if you get threatened, here they are. You know, reach out and touch them. They are just as much for the defense of our commitments to you as nuclear weapons that we would forward deploy in the region or on your territory and so forth. And so, sure, like would a country that really wanted to host them feel reassured that those nuclear weapons were for their defense or even, you know, conventional weapons? Sure, but there's other ways that you could reassure them probably as well. And likewise, on the flip side, I think some people really worry that, oh, if we deploy this class of weapons and we start, you know, a regional arms race with INF range forces, that's going to really tank regional security. And I'm sort of like, have you looked at everything else going on in the region right now?
Yeah.
Like the bulk of China's, you know, missile forces are already INF range capabilities. I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, be glib about it, but it's sort of like, you know, a drop in the bucket. And so I just have a hard time getting too excited about that issue either way.
Yeah, the theory of the case is it's, you know, sort of Europe in the 1980s and the deployment of Pershings and so forth pushes the Soviets into arms control and we win the game of chicken. I don't see the Chinese doing that, to be honest. I don't know if you do. I don't see us deploying INF forces or our allies doing it, getting China any closer to arms control. I think the Chinese are going to resist arms control, frankly, until there's a crisis that's existential for them, until they become scared of the possibility of nuclear war. Because the whole history of China's, of the PLA, really, but also China's rocket forces is to mask weaknesses, project strength, keep us guessing. There's nothing in the culture of the PLA that would lead us to arms control, unless there's like a Cuban Missile Crisis that scares them as human beings. That may be too pessimistic, but since you've been so pessimistic today, maybe you agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think this question of how do nuclear armed states learn to be afraid enough is a really important one. And unfortunately, your idea that experience is part of it, I think is right. One of the things that's most concerning to me in you know, speaking with Chinese colleagues is that I think they often don't study their past crisis that kind of was a Cuban Missile Crisis, which is the 1969 border dispute with the Soviets that acquired a strong nuclear dimension. You know, and it's a little odd to me because I think that is kind of an episode from their own nuclear history that might caution them. And yet I think it's an episode that American analysts probably study more than it appears Chinese do sometimes. And so it kind of goes to your point about not kind of discussing these issues. You know, I think as to whether there's a way to kind of pressure China into arms control, I mean, I go back and forth on this question. You can't really predict it. I think the argument in favor of the INF deployments in the region would be exactly what you just said. It would be like dual track redux. You know, and for listeners who may not have followed that episode, this is the US play in the Carter administration to basically you know, tell the Soviets we're going to deploy a new class of pretty threatening missiles, you know, the Pershing 2 and the Griffin missiles in Europe at the same time that we're going to pursue armed control negotiations with you. So we're going to, you know, it's the carrot and the stick. We're going to deploy this, but we're also going to be open to arms control. And I think the argument for that in Asia is that, yeah, you know, China does have so many of its missile forces in the INF range. And so if the U.S., you know, is competing in that area, it might be able to push China towards some sort of larger agreement framework that would just regulate the number of launchers, right? So the U.S. might have more strategic range, but they have more INF range. But again, from China's perspective, and China's made this pretty clear to your point, they're sort of like, what's in this for us? Like we're way behind in this arms competition. Like, why would we lock ourselves into you know, this lower level of forces with you, the United States, which has the most powerful nuclear arsenal in the world and has conventional forces all up and down the first island chain. So I get that. And I think, you know, if the two sides are to pursue arms control, I think they're going to have to start with measures that are way, way short of those ambitions.
We absolutely should try. We shouldn't bet a lot on it, but we absolutely should try. The allies will want that, both for reassurance that we're trying to control this race, but also because we're spotlighting the threat and showing we take it seriously. So we need to try, but I'm skeptical that we'll get the Chinese to the table successfully anytime soon. Last quick question. You mentioned Japan's standoff strike capability development, South Korea's and their SLBM, of course, Australia with its nuclear-powered sub plan, AUKUS, and their own quite substantial plans for developing production of Tomahawks and LRASMs and other precision strike systems in Australia. So where are you and the allies developing more ability to reach out and touch China or North Korea?
Well, I think if you're remaining committed to the project you mentioned a few moments ago, which is the project, the grand strategic project of preventing China from dominating its region as a hegemon, if that's an outcome you don't want to see, then I think, yeah, allies definitely have to do more, certainly in the conventional domain, to defend themselves and be difficult to coerce and difficult certainly to conquer. I mean, I personally, one of the things I find most puzzling about everything China's been doing, especially in the last 5 or so years, is I think they really have provoked almost a premature balancing coalition against them. I mean, I think that's really what you're seeing where, you know, if I were China and I were my rational actor self and I were reading Waltz and I was, you know, an IR theory student, I would kind of, you know, to use the old cliche, I would kind of hide and bide. I would just be chilling out, building up my military, but I wouldn't be doing trade embargoes on Australian products. And I wouldn't be doing all these incursions into the air defense identification zone of Taiwan. I just wouldn't be picking fights in the South China Sea. I just kind of chill and let the US have to do all the heavy lifting on trying to balance me. And instead, China's, I think, provoking a lot of counterbalancing, and you're seeing it in the examples that you mentioned. And I think given some of the signals that we're seeing about, you know, potential Chinese intentions, if you want to stop a bid for Chinese hegemony, yeah, you're probably going to have to, you know, get allies to do more. And they are doing more because I think they're alarmed.
Yeah, that's a whole longer discussion, of course. Why is China doing this? And it's possibly because they can. It's possibly because the feedback loop is not working under Xi Jinping and they're not sort of processing this. And it's possible because they think it doesn't matter. In any of those explanations, our allies are doing the right thing. What we need to do, I think, in the U.S. is catch up to that debate. Our dialogue bilaterally and collectively with our allies on extended deterrence, on missile defense, is much more robust than it used to be. When I went to Tokyo University in the 80s, there was one professor in Japan who taught nuclear strategy, and they were constantly trying to fire him. Now they're everywhere. I mean, there are Caitlin Talmadge wannabes all over Australia, Japan, Korea, because it's so important to their country's future. But we have a lot of work to do, government, scholars, civil society, expanding our discussion with allies in this, because it's moving so quickly. And you really, Caitlin, did a terrific job in 35, 40 minutes in sort of capturing the essence of what we need to be talking about. So thank you. And thanks for all the work you're doing on this.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here. Great, great questions. I always learn from you and from your work. I'm just a big fan and I really, really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks so much.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more on strategy and the Asia program's work, visit the CSIS website at csis.org and click on the Asia program page.